Hello again, everyone, and welcome to another edition of KHOI Community Radio's Capital Week, where we talk politics Iowa style and explore and analyze who's been making news in and around the state capital, what that news is, and what it all means. I'm Dennis Hart, joined as always by my partner in politics, Laura Bellin of the blog site Bleeding Heartland. Laura, good to be with you again, especially on this Christmas week.
Yes, hello, Dennis.
We have lots to talk about, and we will start where we've started so many times before, with the coronavirus onslaught around Iowa and the nation. There was word on this Monday afternoon that the Omicron variant of the virus has swept the nation. It is now the dominant version of the virus in the U.S., accounting for 73% of new infections. This coming just a few days after there was word that the variant has now been found in Iowa, in Story, Black Hawk, Jefferson, Johnson, Lynn, Polk, and Scott counties at the least. Laura, we knew it was coming, this Omicron variant. It is here, and it is bad news.
Yes, I mean, I think it's safe to assume it's probably just about everywhere in Iowa. And just like the Delta variant became dominant in the state in a very short amount of time, it looks like the same process is going on with the Omicron variant.
Right. And hospitalizations in Iowa due to the coronavirus reached a new high for the year last week, the third straight week that a new high had been reached. And as of this Monday, 788 people were in Iowa hospitals because of the virus. 171 of them are in intensive care. Again, bad news, a bad indicator.
Yes, and I'm seeing more and more healthcare workers express a lot of concern about what's about to hit. You know, this Omicron variant is hitting just during the holiday season when people tend to get together with friends and family they haven't seen for a long time. They travel. They may spread the virus there and then bring it back home. And so it really could be a difficult next few weeks in terms of hospitalizations. Of course, it takes a while for new infections to make people ill enough to require hospitalization care. And we're already at numbers where we don't have a lot of slack at all in the hospitals. We don't have a lot of extra ICU beds. And these, as we've discussed before, COVID patients who are in the ICU tend to stay there for a long time and occupy a bed for a long time.
And 81% of those hospitalized have not been vaccinated. And every health expert in the United States, everyone in the world is saying vaccinations may not prevent you from getting the virus or the variant, but it will very well could keep you from being seriously ill or hospitalized. And yet we still have a significant number of people in Iowa who are not vaccinated.
Yes. And now we have also a number of people, about 40% of the fully vaccinated people are boosted. But we know that for people who had their vaccines more than 6 months ago, they probably have waning immunity. And it's very important for people to get those boosters if they haven't already. They also, I saw somebody was reminding me today that there's this group of 12 to 15 year olds who were in a donut hole where they were allowed to get vaccinated starting in May and early June. And yet they haven't been approved yet for booster. So they would be probably on track to need a booster right now, but they're not able to get one. And so those are kids who are primarily in schools and in a position to get sick and spread the virus to a lot of people in a short amount of time, either in their classrooms or on the bus or whatnot.
130 more coronavirus deaths were confirmed in Iowa last week. That's the most reported in a single week since February. 9,500 new cases of the virus have been confirmed around the state over the previous 7 days. The state's 14-day positivity rate hovering around 11%. All of this boding poorly as we go into the coldest time of the year when more and more people will be inside.
Yes. And again, I want to stress that there is a lag time in the reporting of deaths. So those deaths that were reported last week and added to the website, those occurred over a time span of about 8 weeks. But we are seeing, if you go back and look at the numbers for October and November, we are losing about 100 or more Iowans a week to this virus. So it's a very serious situation. I mean, it's clearly going to be the third leading cause of death again in 2021, just as it was in 2020.
And unfortunately, all the experts are saying that this winter coming up in the next day, the first day of winter, is going to be very bad in terms of the coronavirus because this variant, the Omicron variant, is so virulent, not in terms of the intensity, but it spreads so much faster than the Delta variant did.
Yes, and it could be, I mean, we're still looking through the evidence on it, but it could be as contagious as measles, which is really incredible. And in the first variant of COVID-19, the original variant, they said that if somebody in your household had it, but they were careful about wearing masks and not being close to others, you had a decent chance of other people in the hospital or in the household not being infected. And what I'm hearing now with Omicron variant is that that's almost impossible. I mean, if one person in the household gets it, brings it home from school, brings it home from work, everyone is going to be infected. And we hope if people are vaccinated, we hope it's very likely that their symptoms would be just mild, but you never know. And then, of course, there are a lot of people who are immunocompromised or for other reasons don't mount as strong a response with their immune system, even despite being fully vaccinated. So it's still a dangerous situation.
So while all of this is going on, the State House Government Committee confirmed last week that Iowa lawmakers have drafted a bill to prohibit employer vaccine mandates. It would prevent businesses from firing individuals who refuse a coronavirus vaccination. The timing on this, to say the least, is questionable.
Well, and if people are wondering, didn't they already do something like this? When the legislature met in October to approve the redistricting plan, they also passed a bill that would, it allowed an employer to have a vaccine mandate, but it required employers in Iowa to accept a broad range of exemptions. If somebody, if one of their employees didn't want to get vaccinated, they had to accept these exemptions. But there were a lot of Republican lawmakers who weren't happy with that bill. They voted for it grudgingly, but they said, we want to come back and do more. And this is the more that they want to accomplish during the next legislative session, to say that employers, and it's interesting because traditionally the Republican Party of Iowa has been very aligned with business and has not been about passing laws that say what business owners can or can't do. I mean, generally speaking, the GOP is a party that doesn't stand for a lot of micromanaging by government of what businesses can do and on what conditions they can fire employees. But this seems to be an issue, this vaccination issue. Of course, there's a political correlation between who does and doesn't want to be vaccinated. We've seen that again and again, that the least vaccinated counties are some of the most heavily Republican counties. And so I think in that sense, these legislators are representing their constituents who feel very strongly that they don't want to be vaccinated and they don't want to have to give up a paycheck because of that decision.
Right. And there was a report last week that 94% of Democratic adults in the nation have been vaccinated. 60% of Republicans have been. 40% refuse to get vaccinated. It's very much a partisan issue. Unbelievably enough, it's a partisan issue.
Yes. And in 2020, there wasn't as much of a disparity in the death rates. First of all, of course, the vaccines weren't available. And so you didn't have that factor playing into whether people were getting sick or dying. But you had a lot of heavily urban areas, blue areas, where the virus hit early before there were mitigation measures in place. And so those areas had large numbers of cases and deaths. And then later, as the virus started spreading more across the country, you started seeing higher case numbers in Republican states, Republican counties. And so that has just been exacerbated. Every month that people are tracking the data in 2021, that disparity just grows, where you have more case growth, more deaths in per capita, rather, not an absolute number, but per capita, you are having more deaths in the more Republican areas. And it's correlated with the lower vaccination rate in those areas. And it just doesn't,
right.
Nothing seems to be changing people's behavior, people's decisions. And what I hear from my contacts who live in smaller Iowa communities is that mask wearing is almost non-existent in their towns. I mean, they might go to the store and not see anybody else wearing a mask.
Right. And we're seeing much the same thing out here in the central part of California, where many people, this is a conservative area where we are, much of the population is refusing to wear a mask inside, even though a statewide law went into effect last week, mandating indoor mask wearing everywhere. Meanwhile, Governor Reynolds made news of her own on this late last week, saying she was disappointed by a court of appeals decision letting President Biden's coronavirus vaccine mandate for bigger private employers move ahead. And she says the state of Iowa has asked the U.S. Supreme Court to stop the mandate. She just is adamantly opposed to anything the Biden administration wants to do to stop the spread of this virus and force some vaccines.
Yes. And a federal district court had placed an injunction on that rule. Of course, the governor was very happy with that. And then so when the U.S. Appeals Court panel overturned that, she was upset. So a lot of GOP governors appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court. It's not clear. So far, the people who are challenging state level vaccine mandates haven't had any success with this U.S. Supreme Court, even though it's conservative dominated. So we're going to see if this is any different. Challenging a federal vaccine mandate as opposed to a state level vaccine mandate.
There are a couple of coronavirus related stories that we still have to talk about. One of them involved the former state of Iowa epidemiologist, Dr. Caitlin Padotti. She resigned a few months ago, and she's accepted a new job in Virginia. Let's talk about that.
Yeah, so she has a local job as a district health director in Virginia Beach. Caitlin Padotti grew up in the Virginia suburbs of D.C. She went to college and medical school in the D.C. area. And so while she spent several years, a couple of years in Nebraska, and then, of course, 3.5 years in Iowa, it's not surprising that she would want to go back to her home state where she probably has a lot of friends and family. And I'm going to be keeping an eye on this Virginia Beach Health Department because Caitlin Padotti was really absent for about the last year. The early months of the pandemic, she was very present frequently at the governor's press conferences, and then she sort of disappeared. She didn't grant a lot of media interviews. Her name wasn't on very many of the Iowa Department of Public Health's press releases. And so I just wonder whether she had any quiet disagreements with the state of Iowa's approach. So, for instance, I'm going to be watching to see whether the Virginia Beach Health Department is encouraging people to wear masks and is encouraging some of the mitigation that the state of Iowa's public health department stopped doing. So I think it's going to be interesting to see.
I was about to talk about that part of her departure. In the early days, as you say, she was Governor Reynolds' right hand at the news conferences, often speaking about matrixes and why they weren't imposing mask mandates or other measures. And she did disappear near the end. And so the question I think a lot of us had was she, if not forced out, did she force herself out?
Well, I went back and looked after the department announced that she was going to be leaving in September. They announced she left in late October, but they announced it in September. And I went back and I checked the video from the governor's press conferences. The last press conference Dr. Padotti appeared at was in December of 2020. So there were a number of press conferences, for instance, when the governor announced in February of 2021 that she was lifting all of the social distancing requirements and all, even the partial mask mandate. I noticed in May that Dr. Padotti's name was not on the letter that went out to daycare centers and schools that discouraged them from requiring masks and discouraged them from requiring quarantines and said treat COVID-19 like other childhood illnesses. Also, her name was not on the school guidance that went out in August that's also discouraged even the voluntary. I mean, it didn't even encourage voluntary use of mask wearing in schools. And so I wonder, again, she hardly gave any interviews in 2021 at all. And I just wonder whether secretly she felt that the state should be doing more to encourage people to wear masks, even on a voluntary basis. And maybe that wasn't a message that the administration wanted out there. I really don't know. It's something that I'll be filing some records requests to see if I can get any correspondence related to any disagreements she may have had either with the governor or with the top leadership at the Department of Public Health. But I thought it was striking that the state medical director, that her name was not on some of that guidance that the state issued, particularly to schools in May and again in August.
It is 13 minutes after the hour, wherever you're listening, in whatever time zone. And this is KHOI Radio's Capital Week, where we talk politics, Iowa style. I'm Dennis Hart, and my partner is Laura Bellin. We are here every week at this hour. And speaking of public records, here's a segue for you, Laura. The American Civil Liberties Union of Iowa filed a lawsuit on behalf of three reporters and three media and open government organizations to compel Governor Reynolds to release public records regarding the coronavirus and other things. Now, I should mention that the organizations include you and Bleeding Heartland, Clark Kaufman and the Iowa Capital Dispatch, and Randy Evans of the Iowa Freedom of Information Council. Laura, you have the stage.
Yes. Yeah, so we filed this lawsuit because the open records law is not optional. It does apply to the governor. And what we've seen during the pandemic is that the governor's office has systematically ignored the law and not provided records, and in many cases, not even acknowledged records requests. So the lawsuit mentions 8 specific requests that the governor's office has not fulfilled. The most recent of those was from Randy Evans, filed that in August of this year. But my 5 requests that are cited in the lawsuit, the oldest dates to April of 2020. There are 2 dating to July of 2020, and there are 2 dating to the Kaufman's records requests also date to April and May of 2021. So the issue, it's very simple. We're not asking for money. We're not asking for any damages. We're just asking for the governor's office to comply with the law, provide the records that we've requested, and we're asking for a court injunction to say that the governor's office has to follow the public records law going forward.
Okay, so let's just get this on the table right now in case somebody is wondering or going to ask. This is not a partisan request, is it? If the governor, whoever the governor is, were a Democrat or an independent, I'm going to ask you, would this lawsuit be filed?
Yes, I think so. I mean, I think that there's no question. We've never had a governor. This is one thing that Randy Evans, who is the executive director of the Iowa Freedom of Information Council, pointed out. And he worked at the Des Moines Register for decades before taking his current position in retirement. So he's been an active member of the Iowa journalism community almost since the open records law was passed in the 1970s. And we've never had an administration in this state that just flouted the law in this way. He said a long string of governors for 4 decades regularly responded to the request for public information made by journalists and ordinary citizens, but the Reynolds administration has not responded with the same transparency. And that is why this lawsuit is happening. And I should say that I filed many records requests with the governor's office prior to the pandemic and didn't have this issue. I don't think I ever had to wait more than 2 months for records. And so now, again, I've been waiting 20 months for for one of my requests and more than a year for a couple of others.
So the lawsuit's been filed. What redress are you seeking? Monetary damages or anything like this?
No money. We're not asking for anybody to be fired. We're asking for the records to be provided and for the court to issue an injunction so that the governor's office going forward has to follow the law.
All right. We will obviously keep everyone advised on how this goes, and you'll hear about it on Capital Week with Laura Bellin, and you won't have to file a Freedom of Information request to hear it. In other news, the state of Iowa has appealed the district court decision handed down 1 month ago that found the state's law targeting transgender Iowans unconstitutional. This is a big deal.
This is going to be very interesting. So this is the law that was passed in May of 2019 in response to an Iowa Supreme Court ruling that found that the longstanding policy that Iowa Medicaid has had that doesn't cover gender-affirming surgery for transgender Iowans, that this policy violated the Iowa Civil Rights Act. That's what the Iowa Supreme Court unanimously found in March of 2019. The Republicans in the legislature responded, and Governor Reynolds signed a law that carved out an exemption in the Iowa Civil Rights Act that said that you can't require a public funded health program to fund this kind of surgery. And so the ACLU of Iowa sued on behalf of 2 transgender Iowans very soon after the law was signed for procedural reasons. That first lawsuit ended up not advancing. The court found that the plaintiffs had to exhaust other administrative remedies first. And so they went through, jumped through those hoops, and now they're back in court again. So the Polk County District Court found last month, this was a really wholesale victory, I would say, for the plaintiffs and for the ACLU of Iowa, that found that this law and this policy that DHS has had is unconstitutional. It violates the equal protection provision of the Iowa Constitution. And that not only, this is getting a little bit into the legal weeds here, but when courts consider whether a law is constitutional, they can hold it to a high standard, like strict scrutiny, or they can hold it to just a lower bar, which is called rational basis. And it's much better for the government if they can have the court look at whether there's just any rational basis for this law. And this judge said that not only does this law and this policy not withstand strict scrutiny, it doesn't even withstand a rational basis standard. There is no rational basis for denying medically necessary surgery to transgender Iowans on Medicaid. And so this is what the state is appealing now. They're going to ask the Iowa Supreme Court to consider. And in the 2019 case, the Iowa Supreme Court didn't look at the constitutional question because they just said, well, it's easy. This law just violates the Iowa Civil Rights Act, which protects against discrimination over gender identity. So now that this carve out has been added to the Iowa Civil Rights Act, the Iowa Supreme Court is going to have to come back and look at the constitutional question, and we'll have to see whether they agree with a Polk County District Court judge. By the way, it was a judge appointed by former Governor Terry Branstad who handed down that decision last month.
What was the state's rationale at the time for passing the law?
Well, this is a good, you know, they didn't really have one. I mean, that was one of the issues that came up. They sort of said in the legal briefs, they said, well, we were trying to save money, but there's no evidence that it saves money by denying surgery. There are such a small number of transgender people on Medicaid, and by denying them access to surgery, there is evidence that It creates other medical expenses like treatments for anxiety and depression and other conditions. And so the state really struggled. That was one thing that the judge said, that they couldn't demonstrate that there was any governmental, any legitimate government interest. When during the legislative debate, they didn't really give a reason. They just said, well, this is a policy that we've had for years and we want to allow this policy to continue, the one that the Iowa Supreme Court had struck down. And so, but that's, I think, a problem that the state may have when this is argued in the Iowa Supreme Court, is that they don't have a very strong argument for what is the benefit to the government or the benefit to the citizens of Iowa of denying this small number of people surgery, especially since in some cases that it came up in the plaintiff's briefs that sometimes the exact same surgery. So for instance, like a breast reconstruction, Medicaid will cover that. If it's after a cancer surgery or after a disfiguring accident, but they won't cover it if you're transgender. And so, I mean, that's the issue, is that Medicaid seems to be drawing this line solely on the basis of someone's gender identity.
All right, we will be following that. I should interject something here, almost breaking news. There is word as we go live on this Monday night that President Biden has been exposed to the coronavirus. He has tested negative for it. He was in close contact with an aide who tested positive today. The president is going to be tested again on Wednesday. This is potentially disturbing news.
Yes. And President Biden has been vaccinated and boosted. But as you know, they said they are going to have to test him several times because a lot of people tested negative once or twice before they tested positive. So this will be something they track closely. And we'll have to hope that if the president was exposed, that it would be a very mild case or perhaps even an asymptomatic case.
Indeed. And again, this is breaking news as we go live on Monday night. And that is virtually all we know at this moment. Going back, Spirit Lake Republican Dave Rowley of Iowa won a special election for a Northwest Iowa state Senate seat last week, keeping that district in Republican hands. Let's talk about that vote.
Yeah, so this is the second most Republican Iowa Senate district in the state. So this is an area that has about a 3-to-1 registration advantage for Republicans. So Democrats did nominate a candidate, but there wasn't really any question about who was going to win. This is a seat that was previously held by Zach Whiting, a former aide to Steve King. He was elected to the Iowa Senate in 2018 and decided in October that he was going to move out of state to take a job with a conservative think tank in Texas. So that's why this election was for Dave Rowley. He's the president of the Independent Insurance Agents of Iowa. He was apparently recruited to run for this seat, and he did say that he's going to be running for re-election next year. Of course, the districts have been greatly reconfigured next year, so it's going to have much different shape, but it will still be a heavily Republican area in Northwest Iowa that he'll be representing. So this election that was just for filling out the last year of Zach Whiting's term, and then Dave Rowley is going to have to be on the ballot again next year for a full 4-year term.
And we should point out that District 1 incorporates Clay, Dickinson, Lyon, Osceola, and Palo Alto counties. Another election word last week, fundraising powerhouse Emily's List announced it's going to back Iowa Democrat Abby Finkenauer in her bid for the U.S. Senate seat now held by Republican Chuck Grassley. Why is this a big deal?
Well, everyone's been waiting to see how long it would take. In 2019, Emily's List endorsed Teresa Greenfield in that Senate primary about 2 days after she launched her campaign. And Abby Finkenauer did have Emily's List support in her 2018 and 2020 races for the U.S. House. And so when she launched her Senate campaign in July, I thought that Emily's List would be getting behind her very soon. The Emily's List exists to elect pro-choice Democratic women to offices at all levels. And so right now we have a Senate field with 3 men running and 1 woman. So again, it's no surprise that Emily's List would be getting behind Abby Finkenauer, but it's important because this group helps campaigns raise money. It has a very large network of donors across the country. And also, it spends a lot of money on behalf of the candidates it's supporting. And what I tried to get an answer from the PAC last week and couldn't get an answer is, will they commit to only spending for positive messages about Abby Finkenauer before next June's primary, or might they again spend money on negative ads? Because before the 2020 Senate primary, Emily's List spent a little bit more than $900,000 on negative ads attacking Mike Franken, who was seen as the leading rival to Teresa Greenfield, who ended up being the nominee. So again, didn't get any commitment from them. And I should also say that the day after Emily's List endorsed these candidates in the House and the Senate races, they also endorsed Deidre Dejere for governor. Right now, there are two serious Democratic candidates running for governor, Roz Smith, state representative from Waterloo, and Deidre Dejere. And so Emily's List support for Deidre Dejere could be very important, again, in fundraising, especially if they spend money on advertising for her before the June primary. That could be very helpful to her. And we don't know yet whether another candidate may declare in the governor's race, but this would be the kind of news that might make you think twice if you were a Democrat thinking about getting in the race for governor.
So this is a real monetary jet injection into Finkenauer's campaign and a real advantage over Democrat Mike Franken, who's also running for the nomination against Chuck Grassley.
Yes, and Mike Franken got in the race late. He announced in October, so he won't declare any fundraising numbers until the end of January. But Abby Finkenauer already raised over $1 million just by the end of September, and she's probably raised quite a lot this quarter. And then Emily's List, of course, will be helping her to raise more, and we don't know how much Emily's List may spend on her behalf. So that'll be something when the next quarterly fundraising reports come out, which is at the end of January, everyone's going to be looking to see, first of all, did Mike Franken even raise enough money to run a credible statewide campaign? And also, how much of an advantage does Abby Finkenauer have? I think you have to say that she is the front runner going into this primary campaign.
We have about 3 minutes left. In another story last week involving the U.S. Senate, it voted along party lines to increase the nation's debt limit by $2.5 trillion, enough to avoid a default until 2023. Every Democrat voted for it in the U.S. Senate. Both Iowa senators, Republicans Grassley and Joni Ernst, voted against it. So they apparently did not care whether there was a default, or was this just a show vote?
Yes, I think that what was interesting is that the Republicans were happy to let a carve out to the filibuster rule in the Senate happen just to make sure that they didn't need any Republican votes to raise the debt ceiling, because they didn't really want to crash the economy, but they also didn't want 10 Republicans to have to add their votes to get the debt ceiling raised. But what I saw a lot of commentary last week scratching their heads, wondering why did the Democrats only raise the debt ceiling by enough to get us until 2023? Because if the Republicans are in control of Congress after the next midterm election, which looks fairly likely, I would say, we could have a kind of hostage situation that we had in the early 2010s, where the Republican controlled Congress demanded a lot of concessions from the Obama administration in exchange for allowing the debt ceiling to be raised. So we don't really know what kind of problems we could be having in 2023. And really, the Democratic majority, they could have used their majority to raise the debt ceiling by 10 trillion or 20 trillion. Really, I mean, there's no limit to what they could do.
Right. We have about 90 seconds left. I want to get to kind of a fun story here, our last story before Christmas time. On the alcohol front in Iowa, yes, Laura, the alcohol front, the State Alcoholic Beverages Commission reported that liquor sales in the state exceeded $400 million for the first time in the past year. Now, this seems like a light story, but experts say the increase in sales might be due to buying habits formed because of the coronavirus pandemic, when a lot of consumers had nothing else to do but drink. That's an interesting story.
Yes, and the state legislature last year made it easier for people to buy takeout cocktails, and there were other ways. Even though bars and restaurants were closed for a short time, they were opened up again in Iowa a lot sooner than in many other states. And then, of course, the legislature ended up making permanent some of these temporary rule changes to allow people to get takeout of the hard liquor. And so this is something, I mean, we'll have to see what the results are in terms of the public health impact.
And in case you're wondering, Laura, and our audience, the preferred liquor in Iowa is whiskey, followed by vodka and rum. And I really don't have much to say about that.
Right.
Well, we have one more show coming up next week of this year. And Laura, next week, we're going to talk about all that's gone on in Iowa this past year. Brother, has there been a lot of it?
Yes, it's a year in review. Considering that it's what they call an off year, so not the election year, it has been very busy.
And we will be here to talk about it next week at this time. Laura, I want you to have a great Christmas week.
Yes, absolutely. You too. And everybody stay safe out there.
Absolutely. Stay safe and healthy. We are out of time. You have been listening to Capital Week on KHOI Community Radio. A reminder that the views and opinions expressed here did not necessarily reflect the opinions of KHOI Radio or its staff. Laura and I will Zoom right back here in this time slot next week with our last program of the year, as we say. We're going to look back at what happened in politics in Iowa this past year and what we've talked about in our previous 46 programs of 2021. We hope you can join us. Until then, thank you so much for the privilege of your time. We appreciate it and we value it. Between now and next time, we hope you have a great week and a very Merry Christmas.